Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, it's been a most unusual campaign year. We go to the top political scientists to understand what factors might decide the general election. And first, we'll take a look behind campaign events with one of the top campaign advance men. Stephen Jakes has recently written a book, Advance Man. It's a fictional account of the behind the scenes on the campaign trail. We'll find out how much of it is true to reality. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Stephen Jakes. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much, Maria.
It's rare we do fiction on the Scholar Circle, but I think given where we are in the campaign and given your experiences and your expertise, your fictional account may be pretty enlightening for us all.
Hopefully. I wrote it as a novel and in an effort to be able to actually tell a truer tale.
Your book is called Advance Man, this account of behind the scenes on the campaign trail with events. Maybe we should start with what exactly is an advance man?
Advance people, back in the old days, they were just called advance men because mostly that's what they were back in the 60s. The Kennedys actually invented the concept of modern advance. And obviously by the time I came around in the 70s and 80s, it's advanced women too. But that name kind of stuck for kind of generically. And we are responsible for what you see on television. We're responsible for an entire trip of a candidate for president or vice president in order to create the kind of images that you see on television and in the still photos, too, and the next day in the newspapers, but primarily TV. So what you see is what we create. And what we try to, for lack of a better term, manipulate is an entire trip so the media uses that 30 seconds of tape that we want them to use with the sound bite and something visually that enhances the message, that kind of graphically represents the message. And generally, you've got 2 or 3 days to put these things together, and often there are 30,000-person rallies that you've got, you know, 2 or 3 days from start to finish, and it gets pretty exciting.
It sounded very exciting from the fictional account, Advance Man, which I gather is real experiences that you have had, particularly with this one candidate who sounds very much like Barack Obama.
The main candidate, the candidate, as he's referred to in the book, a fictional African-American candidate for president in 2008. And it's set between the New Hampshire primary and the South Carolina primary. And it's essentially 2.5 days in the life of a lead advance person for this candidate.
So it really was based on some of your experiences, though the dialogue might not have been exact. There's still some reality embedded in this.
It goes back to my time, you know, not only doing a lead for then-Senator Obama in 2007, 2008, but back actually all the way to 1976, my very first presidential campaign, when I was on the national advance team for Jimmy Carter, and everyone since up until 2008. So I've put together all those experiences, so some of the things in the book may go back to the days when we could get away with a little bit more, and maybe not so much these days where we can't get away with quite as much. I witnessed back in 76 and 80 kind of the last vestiges of what we call buccaneer advance. And back in the 60s, when there were no campaign laws to kind of put guidelines to any of what these guys did. And they would come to town and have to put on not only big events, rallies, they'd have to find all the cars for the motorcade, they'd have to find all the volunteers, which is what we have to do. They'd have to raise all the money to make it happen. And you cut some real deals back in those days to make it happen. That doesn't occur these days anymore. You've got a budget, then you know what your budget is when you go into a town, and the campaign will pay for it or the White House pays for it. So I'm capturing a little bit of the old days of buccaneer advance in my book as well.
You described at the very beginning of your book this sort of confrontation that you had with a fire marshal at an event who's concerned about if there's panic. But of course, you note that you're good at panic.
We're always in it. We're in a constant state of it when you're doing advance. And in the book, I say, look, and there's Secret Service agents around. There's adults around to control the scene just in case we lose all our ability to control our body functions. But fire marshals are always the bane of advanced people. When you're out doing big events, you want to cram as many people into a room as you can. And if more people have shown up that can legally fit into the room, you don't want to stop. Now, fire marshals are one of those things that you just can't control. of all the things that advanced people are supposed to control, which is just about everything within a half-mile radius, fire marshals are one of those things you have absolutely no control over, and they are very serious about their jobs. So I've gone to great extent to mollify fire marshals in my time. You just, you know, you go with it. Sometimes there's things you can't control.
And it seems one of the things that has helped allay their concerns has been getting them introduced to the candidate.
People really enjoy this, and some of them, you know, just when you need somebody to be smitten with the whole concept of meeting your candidate or your president, whoever your principal is, you run into somebody who doesn't care in the least. And so you can't win their good graces by something like that sometimes with some of these people. But most of the time, if you just treat them well and treat them, you know, with a little respect, then things work out okay.
One of the most amusing parts of the book was this character, Dick O'Malley, who was trying to do an expose. You said an expose on Democrats stealing Christmas from orphans. So just a guess that this was a particular Fox News reporter.
I'm not going to go that far. I'll say it's a compilation of kind of the attack news that's out there that will accuse Democrats of stealing Christmas from orphans, or back in the old days when they said that somebody was running for office in Florida and his sister was an admitted thespian. Now, this goes back to the 1940s, but that actually, you know, it's that kind of nonsense. I was kind of referring to that whole genre of attack journalism in this regard. Dick O'Malley is the character that's the kind of antagonist journalist that's looking to find the goods on the candidate. And the one scene that I described close to the beginning of the book where that character hits the trip director in the back of the head at a rally in New Hampshire, that actually did happen.
And would you ever disclose who the journalist was that actually hit one of your people on the campaign trail?
I don't know. It might have been somebody like Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I was wondering with a name like Dick O'Malley if it was Bill O'Reilly.
It could have been.
It could have been. But no names here, but his initials are.
That's right, it could have been. But yeah, that actually is based on a real experience from 2008, early in the primary season. It was kind of an amusing little scene to watch as we tried to
describe that, because I thought it was really well done in the book, what actually happened. That character, the Dick O'Malley character, who may or may not be Bill O'Reilly, was rushing to essentially confront the candidate. And you had organized it so that it wouldn't turn out badly. Can you describe what happened?
Well, in the book, the character, the lead advance, was there for the build the night before as the team was building the site. We put up several layers of bike rack just kind of to keep the press area very clean and keep people from going actually into the press area who shouldn't be there. So there's always that, but it's also to keep kind of the press from going where they shouldn't be in the secured area behind the stage. And I could just see it was a big, wide-open space, and so I'd put a couple layers of bike rack because you can't affix that to a floor in a gymnasium. You can't drive a stake into the floor and make sure it goes nowhere. It is easily moved. And in this particular case, it occurred that this television journalist was there and had just walked right through the secured area and right up to the last line of bike rack, and we put together a group of people to stand right there in front of the bike rack with their backs to that area to kind of block it. As our candidate at the time, Senator Obama, walked by to keep them from literally just shoving their microphones in his face as he tried to get by. And that's when the violence occurred. And happily, the trip director, in my book, he's called Merle, smiled, turned around, didn't get offended by it, was kind of amused by the fact that he'd gotten hit in the back of the head, and turned and smiled. And so later, when I was in the motorcade, and I saw some photos that were sent by a Secret Service agent who was sitting in the stands, incognito, sent some photos, and there were great pictures of this occurrence, where the trip director's turning and kind of smiling. You see him in profile smiling at this Dick O'Malley character.
Who may or may not be
Bill O'Reilly.
And then later, Senator Obama actually asked you about the incident, right?
It was pretty lighthearted after that. Actually, the trip director was kind of concerned, you know, as to whether he'd done something himself, had done something wrong. And so, you know, everybody else's amusement was tempered a little bit by having to reassure the trip director that everything was fine. Everybody knew where that came from. But it was true that as we walked in the lobby of this hotel after that, that the rest of the press corps started yelling to the trip director their approval for what had happened.
So there's a combination of things. You said in one part that it's really artistry. It sounded like that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but there was maybe a little bit of reality about your job. There's another time when you were talking about it being really kind of an addiction disguised as a cause. How would you describe it now, being not so much the writer, but just telling a friend how I describe this?
It's the most fun you can have in politics. It truly is. I mean, it's the most challenging. It's very much of a being in the trenches mentality with the people you're working with, and you get very close to people very quickly. When you're in this situation, these situations where you've got, you know, literally just a very few days to make all this magic happen, and you're going to be judged on it by the national media. It's probably as much of a challenge as you can have, you know, without being shot at. So it's a blast to do. It is very addictive because it's short attention span theater. You have a chance to fill up a legal pad and create all this, create the events. You get the press afterwards. You know whether you succeeded or failed. And you go on to the next one. You're dumped into another town to do it all again. So it's quite challenging, and it's fun if you do it well.
Right. Are you still doing it?
It depends on who calls. Some friends had been after me for a year to help out to do a Bernie trip. And so I did a few Bernie trips in the Midwest here in Kansas City and environs where so I could sleep in my own bed. So I did three of those that turned into an interesting story that I won't get into right now.
No?
Yeah, no. In the end, it was a unique situation. So you don't put two old curmudgeons in the same room.
You mean you and Bernie?
That's right.
I'll take that. In your fictional account, there was another event, series of events, that sounded very real. In this case, there was a professor who was alleged to be engaged in anti-American activities. He happened to be friends with your candidate. It sounded very reminiscent of what Barack Obama was dealing with one of his old friends who is a professor.
There was a metaphor for all of those. I mean, there was a variety of those, not just with him, but with just about every candidate you work for. These little flare-ups that occur that are endless, you know, that become tempests and teapots, and for a very short period of time. And then it's kind of relentless. It just never goes away. There's, you know, it's just the next one, and then the next one, and then the next one. So I wanted to capture that within the construct of one, you know, one kind of worry about one thing that was written in college by this candidate. And there'd also been some stuff about that during the campaign of something he may have written in college. And just, you know, how silly it all becomes after a while. And it doesn't mean you don't have to deal with it. You're forced to deal with it. It's still silly nonetheless. And hopefully I tried to capture a little bit of the humor in it as well.
Now, I hadn't seen this story in the book, but I read about it in one of the other newspapers. It was a Mexican Independence Day trip to San Jose with Jimmy Carter. What was that?
Oh, my gosh. That was one of the biggest. We had other words for it. I'm trying to think of a good word for it. One of the biggest bad trips that occurred during the 76 campaign for Jimmy Carter. It was the Mexican Independence Day parade in Santa Ana. Long story short, he ended up walking a mile and a half parade route with then-Governor Jerry Brown. There was nobody standing along the parade route because everybody was at the end where the speeches were going to be. So they were walking for a mile and a half with, you know, a little cluster of people over here and then a little cluster of people over there. And in the parade, advance team, keeping in mind I'm like the most junior person of a 20-person advance team in 76, we got cattle trucks to put the National Press Corps in. And they could watch, they could set up their cameras and see Jimmy Carter and Governor Brown walking. And that turned into a disaster. They started mooing like cows because there was really nothing else to do along this mile and a half parade route. And then when these cattle trucks pulled up at the speech site at the end, we left them on there. So the cattle trucks were going to be the press risers. Well, the press risers ended up, you know, pulling up in front of most of the crowd. So most of the crowd couldn't actually see Jimmy Carter when he spoke. And it was considered quite the disaster. It was one of the worst disasters. There was other things that went on, but those were things that should have been controllable by the advance team. Governor Carter at the time had a tendency to be able to find his advance people in a crowd and look at them if things weren't going right. So I hid.
Did you ever have a disaster like that again?
Not in my events. Right. They make for better stories, but actually the Bernie story could turn into one of those, but now that the shouting's over. But no, actually, I had pretty, thank goodness, pretty good success in my trips. So I try to keep things as simple as possible. So I haven't had any big disasters to tell the stories about.
The primary goal of the advance team is really about national media coverage. There's so much going on to try to make that national coverage look a particular way. I assume that there's an entire speech, there's an entire event, but you said you're really angling for a particular sound bite. How can you possibly get it to that?
Hopefully the soundbite is generated by the candidate or the president or the vice president, you know, making the singular point about the trip. You hope that that occurs. And if you're good at what you do, you can also kind of create the scene where the visuals around it kind of amplify that particular soundbite. It's subtle. You're trying to, again, for lack of a better term, manipulate the media. The difficulty is that they know that you're trying to manipulate them, and you know they know, and they know you know they know. So it's difficult to actually do that in a sense. On the other hand, you know, visually, we have kind of a captive audience, and so they have to kind of take what we give them, the media, this being the media, in terms of their visuals. So whether they get the soundbite that you want them to, you know, ultimately it's between them and the candidate or the president, and in this case, the candidate.
What are some of the visuals that have made the best event here? So I know you've mentioned that a lot in the book. You also have mentioned it here while we're talking. I read a little bit about gigantic banners.
It was something I was known for to a large extent. Nobody else really did them. And it was back in the late 80s, early 90s, the press, you know, not being insensitive to the fact that we were trying to put on non-paid political ads when we did our public events, kept getting closer and closer shots. So it's basically all you saw was a postage stamp size shot of the candidate, just the head. And so, you know, we created the step and repeat banners, the wallpaper, so that, you know, even a small piece of the background being seen, you could still see a message behind it. My feeling is when you're going outside, you go big, because if you give something the press can't not take, they'll take it. And so I was known for finding places, you know, such as the fronts of you know, the state houses, buildings with large columns, whereon I could affix, you know, 25-foot banners that actually just said the message straight out. You know, just go ahead and say it. Give us two or three words or just something that's visually exactly what you want to say. So I was kind of known for doing that. I did it for the Brown versus Board of Education 50th anniversary celebration in Topeka, Kansas, for an event with John Kerry in 2004, and thought up the idea of equality, opportunity, education, equality, and opportunity in 25-foot banners, and had them made within a couple of days and put up behind the event. So it was smack dab in the middle. And, you know, kind of said what the whole thing was about. And there were stirring visuals within Senator Kerry and leaders of the civil rights movement that were standing around him, as well as Governor Sebelius at the time. So did the same thing at the top of the Rocky Stairs in Philadelphia for a 4th of July event with, you know, Liberty, and I can't remember what the other words were, but there were three banners up there as well. So when you're outside, go big, go very tall, and the press will see that. And as a result, the press will then probably also see the greater portion of the crowd that you have and get more exciting visuals about what's going on.
So given all this and what you've been doing for these campaigns, what insight do you think you can give us in terms of these conventions that have just occurred on the Republican side and are occurring on the Democrat side?
As it has been pointed out, I'm not the first one to say this, but this should be the ultimate in terms of a controlled environment for the parties that are putting them on. And not controlling their environment completely, you know, then the media has expectations that they should. You end up kind of getting less good press when things occur that you didn't expect to have occur.
Like a little plagiarism?
Yeah, that kind of thing, and anybody that's not fulfilling the script. And I look to see a little bit higher level of professionalism on the Democrat side, quite frankly, but I'm probably biased, but I think they probably will. You know, that's reflected in the coverage, whether it's subtle, whether it's overt, that's kind of reflected in the coverage. Most of the visuals should also be completely controlled in this situation. And if you're not controlling those, if there's a foment on the floor, if there's people saying things on the floor that you don't want to have said, then you're not controlling what's being sent out there. And people make their decisions based on what they see. Sad to say it, but people base their decisions based on emotion, and emotion is basically dictated by what they see, the visual acuity. So it's critical. Obviously, they vote on emotion. We can see that with the current nominee for the Republican side. It's pure emotion.
The book, again, is called Advance Man, and it's a terrific insight and very amusing account of what happens behind the scenes in all these campaign events. And with us has been Stephen Jakes. Thank you so much for being with us.
Maria, thank you very, very much.
When we come back, what factors might decide this general election? We'll talk to top political scientists. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. It is quite possibly one of the most unusual election years in recent U.S. history. So what might be the factors that will determine our next president? We're joined by three experts of political science. Jan Lely is professor of government and political science at American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of Who Votes Now? Demographics, Issues, Inequality, and Turnout in the United States. Ricardo Ramirez is a professor of political science at Notre Dame University and the author of Mobilizing Opportunities, The Evolving Latino Electorate and the Future of American Politics. Henry Brady is the dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and a professor of political science and public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He is the author of numerous publications and books, including Voice Inequality, Civic Volunteerism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is great to have the three of you back on the program once again. Thank you so much for being with us and being willing to share your knowledge about elections and campaigns and voter participation, political participation. I thought perhaps we should start big picture, U.S. democracy. Dean Henry Brady, your work on inequality is seminal. Just how unequal would you say the U.S. is in terms of political participation?
It's quite unequal, and it's, of course, partly a result of the fact that it's unequal in terms of economics. And so we have rising economic inequality, and with the increasing importance of money in politics, that increasing economic inequality means that people with lots of money, big surprise, not a fabulous social science finding, but it turns out that people with money are much more likely to give money to campaigns. They've got the money to give, and therefore they have a much greater impact, one has to presume, on the outcomes of campaigns and in politics in general. And that's just something that has been growing with the increasing importance of the top 1%. Actually, the top 0.01%, believe it or not, has an enormous contribution to campaigns and to politics these days. So tremendous inequality. Another big thing in America that's a very big issue is polarization. We started seeing that among elites maybe 30, 40 years ago. It now seems to have spilled over into activists and even now into the general public. And that's part of what we're seeing today, I think, with respect to everyday events with a really polarized nation in terms of political perspectives.
Wow, you've said a couple of mouthfuls there. So first of all, in terms of political participation, I imagine a big part of that in the campaign contributions really gets back to what candidates are even possible for to represent us. And I wonder if, before we talk about some of these trends more, if you could assess how Bernie Sanders fits into that. It seems like he debunked the old system a bit with these smaller contributions. Would you say that's true?
Well, I think that's true to some extent. And what's interesting is he, of course, is riding a wave of discontent and unhappiness with inequality in America, as is, by the way, Donald Trump to a significant extent. And so both of the candidates who you might consider outsiders and who you might say, well, they don't really fit the pattern of essentially being the candidates of Wall Street or of people with lots of money, they're really focused a lot on inequality, and that's been part of the reasons they've been appealing. Now, Trump also adds to that a real focus on race and essentially a xenophobic perspective on public policies.
Well, Jan Lely, let's bring you in. You have also explored participation. Would you agree with Henry Brady's assessment?
I do agree with Henry's assessment. Certainly the importance of inequality in terms of every type of participation really that we consider, but I think especially and importantly in the case of voter turnout. Most of the work that we have done on inequality and voter turnout is focused on presidential elections. I suspect that the substantial income bias that we observe in presidential elections, the greater tendency of high-income people to vote compared to low-income people, that tendency is all the more striking, I think, in off-year or congressional elections, if you will, or state elections. In this year, of course, we focus on presidential elections, but we have all those other elections that also determine important policy outcomes that probably has that inequality even more at the forefront. I'd also note a big difference. You mentioned the Sanders campaign, that, you know, the other inequality that has actually increased over the past 30 or so years has been participation of youth relative to older individuals, where the gap between turnout of older individuals compared to youth is actually substantial. And that is a striking difference, I think. So Bernie's appeal to youth makes me pause and wonder. He did motivate a lot of youth to come to rallies and such. What happens on election day, though, whether that will follow through as he does not get the nomination, is another story. I don't know that youth will show up to actually cast ballots.
And you think they won't show up to cast ballots because he's no longer a candidate?
If they will decide to vote for Clinton as the candidate, if she'll be able to parlay their enthusiasm for Sanders to get them to come out and cast a vote, or whether they're discouraged by the primary outcome. And that's been some of the pressure and interest of wanting Bernie to bow out at this point, would be to let Clinton focus on wooing his supporters and providing a solid front so that those individuals who Sanders targeted and mobilized actually show up at the election in the fall.
One of the things, Henry Brady, in the PowerPoint that you sent over where you broke down, you know, the supporters of the various candidates, that was quite, it was really interesting to see, you know, how it was broken down by race and educational level. Do you want to walk us through how those candidates fared in each of these areas?
Sure. Both Trump and Sanders, interestingly, have predominantly white constituencies. Now, they're different in other ways, certainly in terms of their policy positions. There's a U-shaped relationship. In other words, on the left and the right, you find actually agreement among Trump and Sanders supporters with respect to things like free trade. They're against it. They think it's a bad idea. And with respect to concerns about lack of economic opportunity in America. So that's motivating both Trump and Sanders voters. The big difference between them, as I said before, is the fact that the Trump voters are much more motivated by concerns about gay and lesbian rights. They're not in favor about race. They're much more likely to be very unsympathetic towards the concerns of blacks in America. They're not very sympathetic towards women's issues. So we're talking about a group that is very much, in fact, characterized by being older, uneducated, white men. And that's been the core of Donald Trump's constituency. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton has a much more diverse coalition, which includes Hispanics and blacks and whites as well. And that's something that's important for her in terms of the general election, without a doubt, and does not bode well for Donald Trump at all, because he hasn't been able to make inroads in those constituencies. In fact, he's found almost every way possible to turn them off in one way or another. So those fundamentals are very much against Donald Trump and very much in favor of Hillary Clinton. The one thing, though, with Clinton is you don't find much enthusiasm for her, and I don't think we've yet seen her put together a set of policy positions that have really gotten constituencies excited about her. There are people who want to vote for her, but they want to vote for her because they think Donald Trump's really not such a good candidate at all, and she's a better alternative. But they're not necessarily enthusiastic about her policy.
Well, I want to get into that material a little bit more, too. But before we do, Ricardo Ramirez, let's bring you in. Now, I know you've also explored these issues, and you've looked at them through the lens of ethnicity and gender, particularly Latinos and Latinas. Really interesting findings. How would you help us understand that voting bloc?
While I focus on those groups in particular, it's still grounded very much in how we understand the disparities in participation in American politics. And the key finding that we shouldn't lose sight of is how much our institutions have changed. The political parties were largely responsible for bringing in new electorates, whether they be women when they got access to the ballot, when it was youth, when it was African Americans, but in particular immigrants in the earlier waves of immigration from Ireland and Italy and what have you. The parties turned them out to vote. So we shouldn't miss sight of that when we're looking at the disparities now, to understand that parties for a long time were moving away from the ground game, from the actual mobilization angle. And when you have two new electorates that are the newest, Asian American and Latinos, consistently they turn out less, but they also get contacted less. So you have this vicious cycle where parties don't think they will turn out, so they don't reach out to them, and therefore they don't help them overcome some of the barriers to participation that previous new electorates had gotten access to. So I agree with Jan in terms of, with Sanders supporters, there was an appeal for youth. We shouldn't confuse an appeal to particular constituents like youth and mobilization. The Sanders campaign wasn't doing an excessive amount of mobilization of youth. He was appealing to them, and that's what kept them going. But in survey after survey, again, you know, certain groups have been left out, and consistently parties and candidates have reached out to whites at the highest level, followed by African Americans, and then Latinos, and then Asians. Part of the reasons or excuses that are given is, well, those electorates are also harder to reach because they move a lot, or if they don't move a lot, they speak other languages, so it's much more expensive to reach out to them. So there's a lot of different factors that ethnicity and immigration bring into it, including language, including the need to be socialized into a political system. And if the parties have missed a whole generation of new Americans, they've then also missed on the second generation. So the U.S.-born children of these immigrant communities are also not being reached out to, even if they might support Sanders or Clinton or other candidates.
Or other candidates. I like how we leave them unnamed. So, you know, I wanted to get a little bit more into ethnicity here as well, particularly with Latinos. We didn't hear as much about Latinos as we did about the black vote when we were talking in the primary period. And this may actually go right to what you were speaking of, Ricardo, in terms of people assessing that they might not turn out as much. But, you know, we have a pretty healthy Latino population of Americans now that would make a big difference for a candidate. Do you have any
sense? They would during the general, but not necessarily in the primary. So in the primary elections, it was set up very few states with significant size of Latino voters were early primaries. So most of the discussion was in the Northeast or the Midwest, and then eventually the South. By the time it got to the Southwest, which is where most Latino voters are located, it wasn't really an issue. Candidates had already been weeded out, and it really came down to, you know, the two candidates for the Democrats, and by then it didn't impact the Republican primaries at all.
Do you think that Latinos are offended enough by the comments of Donald Trump that they will weigh in for Hillary Clinton?
Yes. So a lot of my research and those of a lot of people suggest that my research, I label it as reactive mobilization. So it's the perceived or real threat that a community, in this case Latinos, see in the politics at hand. And now it could be just state-specific or city-specific, but it's when they feel that their community is under threat that they become citizens at higher than expected rates. They register to vote at higher than expected rates, and they turn out at higher than expected rates. And in all three things, we've seen all the numbers go up in key states this election cycle, but in previous election cycles as well. So it just reaffirms some of the research that we found in California in the 1990s and the mid-2000s, and now we're seeing the latest iteration of that, where an electorate that's been slow to be reached out to by the powers that be in terms of getting them through the naturalization process or registering them to vote, they are self-motivating through this reactive mobilization. So they are offended enough, they are scared enough. It goes back to threat. It's not necessarily that they feel offended, it's that they feel threatened by the political system and react to it.
So given all that we are dealing with now, including the disparities in wealth, disparities in political power, the polarization that Henry Brady was talking about, given the two candidates that remain as the nominees, what do you see as the primary factors that are going to affect the November election? Are we talking about, obviously, voter turnout matters, who votes matters. Are there issues that really are going to win the day? Are there going to be issues around character? And both Trump and Hillary have had their characters assaulted in various ways. How do we see this working out? Henry Brady, then Jan Lely, then back to Ricardo.
Well, my bottom line would be that I think Donald Trump has really offended so many constituencies, it's hard for me to figure out how he can win the ultimate prize and become president. And he's even offended lots of people in his own party. So there's just lots of people right now who are Republicans, public office holders, who are not really getting involved with the party. They're probably going to keep their distance during the election. And so that means in a lot of places, he's not going to have the benefits of state party machines. Furthermore, we know that at least so far, he's had a heck of a difficult time getting any kind of organization in place. So he's way behind where he should be with respect to that. And if he can't then count upon state politicians to help him, it's very hard to figure out how he's going to win the election in the end. One of the sad things about that is I think that there's lots of reasons to be concerned about Donald Trump as president, but the sad thing for the Republicans is that they may very well then just conclude, well, they just had a bad candidate, and that explains all their trouble. And one of the things that Donald Trump should be teaching the Republicans is that there's a group within their party, the group that I described before, that's very concerned about economic issues, and that they have to find some policies to help those people. And I think it's very likely that instead what they're going to conclude is they just had a bad candidate, and that therefore they don't have to pay any attention to that group of people, or go back to the old method that they used to mobilize them, which was just to emphasize what we call the social issues, things like abortion and anti-gay sentiment and women's issues and so on and so forth, and basically mobilize them based upon their xenophobia and their fears instead of upon their needs, which happen to have to do with their economic needs. So I think Trump's going to lose, but it may not be the best thing for the Republican Party in that it may just not come to the conclusion it should, which it has to really rethink its policies.
I often wondered if it was going to splinter as a result of Donald Trump.
I don't think that's going to occur. There's too many reasons why that doesn't happen in America, having to do with the nature of our electoral system and the federal system we have, which allows Republican parties, for example, in the various states to sort of remain little islands and to continue. But I think it's going to be a difficult period for the Republicans after the election.
Jan Lely, what would you say?
I would agree with Henry on all of those good points. I think I would also add that whatever the campaign looks like going into the last few days or perhaps weeks, that there's always the possibility of kind of late-breaking issues in terms of international events or domestic crises that could perhaps frame part of the campaign rhetoric and discussion. So that's what will be maybe fun or interesting to keep us tuned in until Election Day to see how the candidates and campaigns react. But at the same time, I would underscore a point that I think underlies some of what Henry said, that most individuals aren't going to be tuning in that much to the campaign as much as perhaps they have during the primaries, and most individuals have already decided and know that they're going to vote for, at least for Democrats, they're going to vote for the Democrats. So the tough decisions to watch are those Republicans who are not pleased with Trump on any dimension, and whether their decision is to stay at home on Election Day or whether they will go to the other side of the aisle and actually cast a ballot for Hillary. So it's those independents and the unhappy Republicans that have some more interesting choices to make.
Jan Lely, you also have looked at the role of mass media, and now we've got not just mass media, but we've got all of this micromedia that seems to have had an effect on the primaries. But then, of course, mass media picking up on those micromedia and really blowing up certain issues larger than life. And maybe one would say, you know, keeping others off the agenda. How would you overall assess the media coverage and its effects up till now and moving forward? What do you expect?
Well, we have a more diverse set of options for citizens to pay attention to the campaign if they're interested. Most are not. I think some of the media coverage exaggerates the interest and engagement of individuals now. And at the same time, the media will, and the new media will, emphasize the importance of both campaigns having strong social media dimensions, and we're still waiting for the Trump campaign to figure out what it's doing along those lines. That has to be more than just Trump on Twitter. So I think there could be some tools to mobilize and persuade in a way that the general national media don't reach certain targets, but the campaigns have to make important decisions on that front.
And in terms of the polarization that Henry Brady mentioned at the beginning of our segment here, do you think the mass media have played a big role in that?
I think there is certainly the role. The easy way to answer that would be to say, yes, we have these persuasive media opinion leaders, if you will, and they affect individuals very strongly. I think part of what tempers that is that in this new world of the news being purposefully biased and with particular agendas, that part of what tempers that the actual impact of that, I think, on polarization is that individuals are selecting into those outlets. So they don't rely on them exclusively, but there's greater opportunity to listen to opinions that are only similar to yours, and that cuts down on dialogue and considering another person's viewpoint. So the other detail, I think, on that is just the tendency of most media to focus, whether traditional or new media, to focus on the horse race and who's ahead and who's behind, or I think the entertainment value of Trump. And as opposed to talking about the issues that Henry has identified or that Ricardo has identified, substantive information about those issues, and that's a bias that's been longstanding. And so whether that reduces the polarization or the media influence, we'll see.
Ricardo Ramirez, what would you say to all this?
I would just add to some of the things that they've said, all we need to look at the groups that Trump has alienated, and among them are his own partisans. And so if we look at some states that have been in play the last few election cycles, if we look, for instance, at New Mexico had been a purple state, and you have a Republican governor, which should have made that a very much of a swing state. But he insulted its Republican Latina governor, and he's made it very difficult for another governor, let's say Brian Sandoval from Nevada, from supporting him. So those two states should have been in play, and I don't know how much they're going to be in play in 2016. And then if we look at one of the key swing states, Florida, he's even alienated solid Republicans in Cuban Americans, where the messages that he's made about Mexicans that get expanded to all Latinos and all immigrants have turned off a lot of Cuban Americans that traditionally are in support Republican candidates. So he's hurting himself, and then you have changes in other states. So the in-migration of blacks from the Northeast and the Midwest to the Carolinas, in particular North Carolina, now you have a state where it shouldn't be in play, and it likely is. We saw Hillary Clinton made her first stop in North Carolina. So the map is changing a lot and not necessarily helping Donald Trump at all, precisely because he's alienating some of the people and groups who might have supported him in the past or a Republican candidate.
So would you say it's a fair assessment that most ethnic voters are going to turn on Donald Trump in large part and go to Hillary Clinton? Or do you think there's a possibility that people stay home?
I think both are possibilities. It all depends, I think, on other state races, if you have Senate races, congressional races, and if people reach out to them, participate. But it's going to make it very hard for people that, even if they do turn out and vote on some of these other elections, they might not be willing to vote for Hillary if they're reliable Republicans. They just can't bring themselves to vote for Trump. But I think it's going to be on a state-by-state or race-by-race basis whether they'll decide to vote at all or stay home, and at the same time impact the outcome of the election.
Henry Brady, anything you'd add to that?
I would add that I think there are some voters who might have been thought of as historically Democratic who might find Donald Trump appealing, and it's the demographic I described before, which is older white men who have maybe lost their jobs in manufacturing, who now are lucky if they can get a Walmart job, which means that they've really gone from maybe $30, $40 an hour jobs to $10 an hour jobs if they're lucky. And they're very upset about what's been happening in America. And I think those voters, who are mostly in the Rust Belt, so that'd be states like Michigan and Ohio and up there, those voters might end up going for Donald Trump. And that could make those states a little bit more in play than they might have otherwise been. I think that one of the things Hillary Clinton has to do at some point, and it's not clear whether she can do it, is to come up with a speech and a set of policies and programs where she really talks about how she's going to deal with inequality, and not just in a piecemeal fashion, but in a really big fashion that galvanizes some of those people to say, yes, she's got ideas about how to solve some of these problems. That would also give her appeal to some of the Bernie Sanders voters, especially young voters. I just haven't seen her do that yet. Now, maybe she's just waiting, and maybe we'll see that at the convention, for example, the Democratic convention. And if I were her, that would be a place I might trot out some of those big ideas and see if they couldn't be used to try to mobilize some of those voters.
I know that in the literature, there's a bit of a divide between whether voters are pocketbook voters voting on kind of the big economic issues, or whether these other less tangible factors are the ones that really drive the voting, you know, emotions and trust and, you know, these values. And George Lakoff always talks about morality, for example. I assume that all of these are going to come into play, but do you have a sense that there's one that is more powerful than the others? Or do you really think that we still have the issue-based voters that if she gives that big speech that will deal with inequality, she can get them?
I happen to think that issues do really matter, and I do think that people do vote based upon economic concerns and also concerns with the social issues, which encompass such things, again, as abortion and how you stand on gay rights and how you feel about race and ethnicity in America. And I think those are very powerful determinants of the vote. On the other hand, of course, people get disturbed if they're facing a candidate who they feel is untrustworthy or problematic in those kinds of ways. On the other hand, Americans voted for Richard Nixon, and most people understood that he wasn't the most trustworthy guy who ever lived. And yet they, at the time, thought he had the right issue positions with respect to Vietnam and some other issues. So I think that character is important, and it can be problematic, but I don't think it's the whole thing by any means. And in fact, I think issues really are much more important.
Jan Lely?
I think Henry's nailed it. Even though character makes valued and makes for good news stories right now, that it's really the issues that are kind of the bedrock. And I think the marginal movement you might see would be which campaign is able to frame the narrative and choose the issues and how to define the issues to keep in voters' mind once we get down to the last week or 2 weeks of the campaign.
Ricardo Ramirez.
Very little to add there. I think even among all these groups who might be mobilized one way or another at the margins, they're still driven by key issues like the economy, jobs, and education. So it's the framing of those issues and how the campaigns kind of sort those issues out that will impact people's decisions. And then subsequently, at the margins, you will see these other issues like race or immigration or some of these other issues. But the core issues are the ones that are still going to be driving things.
A couple of other items that come up from time to time, particularly in some circles around here, deals with the rules and regulations around voting, and people are very concerned about who can vote, who is going to get carded or ID'd, and how they may try to prevent certain types of people from voting as a power play. And we know that that happened with Operation Eagle Eye and those types of activities. Jan Lely, you don't specifically look at voter suppression, but you do look at various kinds of voting rules. How much does that matter?
Well, I think the primaries were a good example about how important those rules are. The harder we make it for individuals to vote, you know, the lower the voter turnout. And that is across the board. So it just how elections are conducted, what hours are available, how far in advance you have to be registered to vote. All of that varies by state. I think it's very confusing to many individuals. So I think it's really important in terms of the actual voter turnout. And then I think there's also the broader consequence, to the extent that these become news stories about voter suppression, then I think it's just another factor kind of reflecting on just the distrust and cynicism that citizens have about government and elections.
And that might also lead people to stay home sometimes.
Exactly.
Like what difference does it make, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Or how really awful it might feel to try to cast a vote and weighing those experiences against actually going and exercising that duty.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I...
But the opposite is also true.
Yes, go ahead.
So we did see in 2012 that in some of the states that had passed some of these rules that made it harder to participate, you actually had an increase in African-American participation. So it makes it very difficult in that people will say these rule changes depress turnout, but in certain situations when, again, that feeling of threat is strong enough, you actually see a mobilization of people that wouldn't have turned out to vote, which muddies the water, because then you can't necessarily assert that making it harder to participate or to vote or to register or what have you necessarily turns participation down, because people then self-mobilize or have this reactive mobilization. So in most instances, I think you will have, especially in the primaries or in the lower level elections, like city elections, county elections, or even state legislatures. But in high impact presidential elections, like 2012, we did see increased Black participation and Latino participation precisely in those jurisdictions that were engaging in some of these changes. And there is variation even within states, because the rules are set by the counties. So some of the legislation is at the state level, but then counties then make other decisions in terms of how long the polls will be open on days before the election in the early voting situations, in the early voting centers, or how many total precincts they'll have. All those decisions are made at the county level. So it makes it really difficult to necessarily say voter suppression necessarily can be spotted when these rules are changed.
The last couple places I'd like to go is really both candidates being a little bit less than ideal in terms of building enthusiasm across their party. We don't have a Barack Obama, for example, who people were enthusiastically for on one side or the other. Or I guess if we're going to look at the Republican side, perhaps Ronald Reagan was the last one that they had like that. Is that going to affect turnout in a significant way, Henry Brady?
Well, I think that's got to be the concerns of the Democrats, that somehow turnout is not what it should be, and that could be very problematic, especially since the Democrats do rely upon a constituency which is lower income, lower education, you know, on average than Republicans, and those people just by exigencies of their life, they've got lots of other things to worry about in their lives, are less likely to vote. So that the Democrats have to worry that low turnout could lead to difficulties for their candidates. So on the other hand, the Democrats have turned out to be very, very good at creating get-out-the-vote campaigns and targeting voters and making sure they get the people out they want to get out. So I think on balance, they'll probably do okay, given that they've got the machinery and Donald Trump doesn't seem to have the machinery going yet, but it's a big worry for them.
I recall in the political science literature, there was this body of work that claimed we had these critical realignment elections. Could this possibly be one?
That was my teacher, Walter Dean Burnham, was actually one of the leading proponents of those kinds of ideas, and it goes back to a Harvard political scientist named V.O. Key. We've certainly seen times like 1896 was one, and 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt became president after Herbert Hoover had been president, that you see just a real resorting of who's with which party. I'm not sure I see that right now. I think more you see turmoil within the Republican Party, and the big question is what's going to happen there and how's that going to sort out. But it's not clear where the constituencies that are upset within the Republican Party, you know, the Trump voters, are going to go eventually. This time they're going to presumably go with Trump. The question is what's going to happen when Trump's not there anymore, and what are the Republicans going to do to keep that group within their tent? And I think the notion that they can keep throwing at the American public the same ideology and the same notions like Obama can't be trusted and you can't trust Democrats, that's a pretty limited perspective. They need something much more positive and constructive. Paul Ryan is trying to get a more constructive perspective put together, but even he keeps focusing on things like cut taxes and cut regulation, and I'm not sure that Trump voters think that's enough. I think they want much more than that. They're very discouraged by the fact their jobs are gone, and they want something done about trying to create jobs for people like them.
Jane Lilly?
As Henry suggests, I think the problem is the Republicans are in disarray. And so this will be perhaps a focal point to shift their party's ideology and a shakeup of leadership. But I think the basic dimensions of the parties and their supporters in the electorate will likely remain close enough that we won't be talking realignment.
Ricardo Ramirez.
The last major realignment that people do agree on is the New Deal realignment. But even within that, there's disagreement on whether the cause of that realignment was the change in people's partisanships or the influx of new voters, because you did have a big increase in new voters. I don't think we're at that kind of situation where that many people would either change their party. But what we do see is that there is a continual influx of new voters that are changing the dynamics, but slowly. It's not going to happen in 2016 alone. It's not going to happen in 2020 alone. It's going to happen over time as you have this group of young voters that's much more diverse and feels a lot different in, on a host of issues, including gay issues and abortion and what have you, and race and immigration. So I think some of the changes in the parties, it won't necessarily look like a critical realignment. I just think it'll happen over time through the influx of these new voters.
Well, thank you so much, all three of you, for being with us here on the Scholar Circle and for sharing your wisdom and your research. Henry Brady, Jan Lely, and Ricardo Ramirez.
Thank you.
Henry Brady is the dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and a professor of political science and public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He is the author of numerous publications and books, including Voice Inequality, Civic Volunteerism in American Politics, and Letting the People Decide. Jan Lely is professor of government and political science at American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of Who Votes Now? Demographics, Issues, Inequality, and Turnout in the United States. Ricardo Ramirez is a professor of political science at Notre Dame University and the author of Mobilizing Opportunities, The Evolving Latino Electorate and the Future of American Politics. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.